This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. This weekend, Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee generally distanced themselves from the president after declassifying a highly controversial memo on Friday. President Trump tweeted that it, quote, totally vindicated him in the Russia investigation. But that remains to be seen. Today, the committee could vote on a rebuttal memo from Democrats, but the president would have to approve releasing that. Let's catch up on where things stand and make sense of the memo, its impact, and of what this means for the president's relationship with federal law enforcement. Joining us here in studio to begin the program is Jordan Fabian, White House correspondent for The Hill. Jordan, welcome to 1A.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And joining us for the hour from Cornell University is Professor Jens David Olien, Vice Dean of the Cornell Law School. Professor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I should note that we did reach out to all the Republican representatives from the House Intelligence Committee. Two told us they were unavailable. Most did not respond, but the invitation stands open. Jordan, let's begin with the basics of the memo. I think a lot was said early on about whether this would be a bombshell or whether this would exonerate people or whether this would finally tell us whether it was Professor Plum in the study with a bowie knife or what it was going to be. What is this memo really? What was it purported to be and what did it turn out to be?
Well, what it was purported to be was something that would undermine the underpinnings of the Russia investigation to show that the entire thing was politically motivated and that it's illegitimate and that some members of the House said should not continue. The actual content turned out to be was a very narrow complaint against a surveillance warrant that was obtained against a former Trump campaign advisor, Carter Page. It had nothing to do, really, with the broader Russia investigation. In fact, it confirmed that the investigation began with the George Papadopoulos information and not this so-called ill-begotten surveillance warrant. So the President Trump afterwards claiming victory, claiming that it vindicates him, but it really did no such thing. That's not to say it's insignificant, because there are some things that are going on about the legitimacy of law enforcement and the conflict there. And so that's politically significant, but the actual contents of the memo turned out to be something of a nothing burger.
President Trump is tweeting about this as we speak. I will make his tweet wait for just a minute. And if we step back just for a minute, Jordan, just remind us about Devin Nunes' role on the House Intelligence Committee. He's had a lot to do with the storyline of Donald Trump's first year in office, for sure. Talk about his responsibility on the House Intelligence Committee and why this memo pegs directly to him.
Well, let's go all the way back to the period after the election. Devin Nunes was an official or an advisor on the Trump transition. So he's a very close ally and confidant of the Trump team. And early on last year, he actually went to the White House and had this bizarre event where he claimed that the President Obama had illegally unmasked intelligence sources related to the Trump campaign. And so that was very controversial. And then he actually stepped back from the Russia investigation. He said he was recusing himself and was not going to be involved with anything at all. And it turns out, well, in the background, he was. He was drafting this memo based on this FISA warrant that was given to the intelligence court and released it. And now he is playing a role in basically helping Trump argue against the Russia investigation politically.
I should note, by the way, we have spoken at length on this program about what the FISA court, this court for the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court for getting warrants to do spying that relates to interactions with people overseas. NPR's Ron Elving was actually on this program last week, and he helped break the whole thing down. You'll find that conversation online at the1a.org. That's the word the number one, the letter a.org. I wonder, Jens, if I could come to you, Professor Olien. There's another piece of this, what's come to be known as the Steele dossier. Remind us very briefly what the Steele dossier was.
So the Steele dossier was originally, it was opposition research into Trump that started during the campaign. It was originally financed by Republicans who were looking to stop Trump during the primary. And when Trump won the primary and became the GOP nominee, the Steele dossier was then, or the Steele work was funded by Democrats, and it basically produced opposition research by Mr. Steele, who was a former intelligence officer who sort of scoured the globe, working for Fusion GPS, which was a research firm, and he uncovered all sorts of information, contacts from Russia about deals, purported sort of unsavory activity involving Trump, all sorts of situations that could potentially result in Trump being blackmailed, and a lot of this information was then handed over to the FBI.
We've got a number of comments from you about this so-called Steele dossier. One of you wrote in our inbox, why do Republicans get away with representing the Steele dossier as a partisan Democratic document? Has everyone forgotten that the dossier was originated by Republicans? Only after they had no further use for it did Democrats pick it up. And Anastasia Nitz tweeted, maybe I'm mistaken, but didn't the dossier originate as a result of opposition research contracted by Trump's opponents during the Republican primary? Professor Olean, I believe that's true. This was a Republican document before it was a Democratic document. So how does that bear on the argument that was made in the Nunes memo that this was all partisan?
It's absolutely correct. And the Nunes memo points out or tries to make a big deal out of the fact that the application, the FISA warrant application to the court didn't specifically, at least according to the memo, didn't specifically state that the Steele dossier was found, was funded in part by the Democrats and people associated with the Hillary Clinton campaign. It's a little bit of a bizarre argument because assuming that the warrant application stated that this was, a private investigator who was doing opposition research, I think the judges could infer that this was opposition research and that this came from an informant, and informants always have, a possibility of an ulterior motive. It wasn't like anyone was pretending that Steele was a government agent, that he was working for the FBI. This is someone who was out there. He was collecting information. He was clearly collecting information to damage Trump, but it doesn't really matter whether or not he was funded at one point in time by Republicans and then funded in a later point in time by Democrats. I just don't think it's very relevant.
We are talking about the memo and what it means going forward with Cornell Law Professor Jens David Olean, Jordan Fabian, White House correspondent for The Hill, and with you, we welcome your questions and thoughts on this. Email 1a@wamu.org. Just within the last few minutes, the president tweeted, quote, Representative Devin Nunes, a man of tremendous courage and grit, may someday be recognized as a great American hero, capital G, capital A, capital H, great American hero, for what he has exposed and what he has had to endure, unquote. Jordan, that seems to kind of get at the heart of the president's argument about the entire Russia probe, really, that the genesis of it and the entire motivation for it are purely partisan.
That's right. And he's using this memo. And I'll point out that Representative Nunes last Friday said there could be more memos coming. So this seems to be a concerted effort to point out what Trump and his supporters see as bias in this investigation, but what others see as an effort to muddy the waters and to keep the focus away from the actual Russia investigation and on the so-called wrongdoing. And I'll also point out that he had another tweet this morning that was criticizing Adam Schiff, the ranking Democrat on the committee, who wants to release a counter memo that would rebut some of the claims that were made in the Nunes memo. The White House last week said they were open to releasing it. Now with Trump coming out and criticizing Adam Schiff, I think that's somewhat called into question.
Yeah, let me read that tweet very briefly from a few hours ago this morning. Quote, little Adam Schiff, who is desperate to run for higher office, is one of the biggest liars and leakers in Washington, right up there with Comey, Warner, Brennan, and Clapper. Adam leaves closed committee hearings to illegally leak confidential information, must be stopped, unquote. Professor, I do want to hear more from you as the conversation continues, but I know we only have Jordan for a few more minutes. So, Jordan, I wonder how you think all of this will affect the Russia investigation going forward. There's still so much fact-finding to be done. Does this memo rate highly in terms of the factors that could have a big impact, or is this more just kind of political theater?
I think for now it seems to be political theater. The findings only have seemed to harden partisans on both sides, with Democrats saying this investigation must continue, Republicans saying, not all Republicans, but many Republicans saying it's illegitimate. The consequences we could see consequences if the president decides to say fire Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, who is named in this memo as having participated in what he sees as an inappropriate application for a FISA warrant. Now, if the president were to use this memo as to make a move against Rosenstein or somebody else in the Russia investigation, Special Counsel Mueller, then we can be seeing some real consequences and some real impact in the probe.
And we should note that the role that the committee has taken, Jordan, is not entirely out of bounds. I mean, the House Intelligence Committee does play a role in regulating the investigation. So this isn't like a memo that came out of nowhere. I imagine some of the conversation going forward, in addition to whether to release this Democratic document, isn't what the proper role of the committee is and how to keep it out of that partisan lane.
Right. And
I'm not sure how you do that.
I think that's broken at this point, honestly. If you look at the history of the Intelligence Committee, it was set up in a way that they would work in a bipartisan fashion, but also accept intelligence and use it properly, not for partisan purposes. That has been thrown out the window in this process.
Jordan Fabian, White House correspondent for The Hill. Jordan, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, sir.
Carlos emailed, the DNC and the Clinton campaign paid a British former intelligence officer to write up a damaging dossier on Trump. Isn't this colluding with a foreign national in an attempt to influence an American election? Where's the outrage over that? Glad to hear some of you sharing your comments and questions. We'll get to more of them as we continue. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing what the GOP memo revealed and what it means in the Russia investigation with Cornell Law Professor Jens David Olin. Professor, before we bring in a few more voices on this conversation, I did want to get to a few more comments from some of our listeners. Kevin wrote on our Facebook page, how can you possibly know what you now know about what the Dems and the FBI did, then still think it is okay? This is not about following a certain ideology. It is about looking at the facts and making a decision. And Harry in Mount Lebanon, Pennsylvania writes, doesn't the president have the constitutional duty to rein in the FBI if he thinks it's jumped the tracks? Professor, what about that? If FBI oversight by the president, maybe more broadly by the House Intelligence Committee, what does the law say about that?
Well, I mean, I'd want to distinguish oversight in the congressional sense from executive control. So the House Intelligence Committee is engaged in oversight of the intelligence agencies, including the FBI, insofar as the FBI is a counterintelligence agency. That doesn't mean that the House Intelligence Committee should be controlling the FBI, but they should be looking over their shoulder to make sure that they're acting appropriately. And if they're not, the House Intelligence Committee can speak up. And that's why the House Intelligence Committee, I think, is looking into some of these issues. Trump, as president, is the chief executive officer of the entire country. And in that sense, he does supervise the FBI. He does so usually indirectly by keeping the FBI director at arm's length. He appoints the FBI director, and then usually the president historically has given the FBI director sort of wide latitude to conduct criminal investigations as the FBI director sees fit, and also to make personnel decisions that the FBI director thinks is appropriate. It's not really part of our sort of constitutional norms to have the president so deeply involved in specific FBI investigations. And that's what got Nixon into trouble by sort of delving deep into what the FBI and the CIA were doing and trying to use their authority in a way that would insulate himself from any kind of criminal scrutiny. And And I think that's where the problem shows up here. No one doubts that the president has the authority to oversee the FBI and that the FBI reports to the president. But if the president is using that authority in a corrupt way in order to shape an investigation that possibly implicates the Trump administration, the Trump campaign, and even Trump himself, then I think that's cause for concern.
We're getting a number of comments from you about the FBI specifically, like from Chris in Richmond, Virginia. Chris writes, many FBI workers are nonpartisans and work hard to protect and serve our nation. It's ridiculous that our FBI has had to spend so much time and energy investigating both 2016 presidential candidates and their associates with dubious international connections, scandalous baggage going back decades. The FBI has been given an unwinnable scenario to do their jobs. Damned if they do, damned if they don't. They are getting trapped in the politics of it all, and the politicians end up being their bosses. The FBI deserves our support. Those who criticize them do not. That might be a good place to bring in our next guest, joining us from Burlington, Vermont. Garrett Graff is the author of The Threat Matrix, The FBI at War in the Age of Global Terror. Garrett, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
What did you think of that last comment, that damned if they do, damned if they don't scenario, particularly because the people who they may be investigating are also their bosses? It sounds like an incredibly tense scenario in which to have to work.
It's certainly tense, and it has been now for, you know, more than a year, coming up on 2 years, actually, with the Hillary Clinton email investigation. But this is part of what makes the FBI unique within the United States government and the Justice Department unique inside the government, which is the Attorney General of the United States and the FBI. They have both sort of a responsibility to as you said, sort of report to the president and to follow the president's guidelines, but they are also the legally designated protectors of the Constitution and have a larger mission above and beyond loyalty to any single office holder. And that's a role that the FBI has had to delicately play for decades now. I think what is important in the current context to remember is that is a unique role. And so it's easy to boil down this memo controversy or even the Russia investigation writ large as sort of yet another fight between Democrats and Republicans, yet a more partisan bickering. But the truth of the matter is that that's not the situation that we're facing today. This is an unprecedented showdown between the Republicans and the institutions of our government that preserve the rule of law. And that I think that that's a very important line to draw and to keep focused on, that this is not the same as the budget fight that we're also going to be seeing play out in Washington this week, because there are real constitutional questions, there are real separation of power questions, and there are real questions about the rule of law wrapped up in the Nunes memo and the Russia investigation writ large.
So Garrett, how is the relationship between the FBI and the White House supposed to work? It's clearly not supposed to work the way it's working now.
No, and there have been tensions in the past. Louis Free had an enormously tense relationship as FBI director in the 1990s with then-President Bill Clinton. The two actually went the last, I think, 2 or 3 years of Clinton's term without speaking at all. But what we have seen since 9/11 is actually a relatively close working relationship, particularly on national security issues, particularly when it comes to counterterrorism, counterintelligence, espionage cases, where the FBI has worked as an integral member of the larger intelligence community and national security apparatus in coordination and cooperation with the White House as appropriate. And that was very much Bob Mueller's model as FBI director. He actually spent years starting each day briefing President George W. Bush in the morning on the terror threats that the nation faced. Sort of he would come right after CIA Director George Tenet and was in the Oval Office every day talking about keeping the nation safe. But what we have seen over the last 2 years is an increasingly strained relationship as the FBI has fought to remain independent and to do the job that it is tasked to do by Congress and by the president to deliver rule of law and pursue justice in the American system.
I wonder, Jens, how we view the tension between the FBI, the president, some in the public. There was some new polling from Axios that shows that the relationship between Republicans, self-identified Republicans in the FBI, the trust has decreased there, according to that Axios poll. And a number of you have commented to kind of that extent as well. Mary emailed, how come no one is recalling that in the 1960s, the FBI was investigating leaders of the civil rights movement and building cases against Martin Luther King Jr. and others? Are there any parallels to today? Christy wrote on our Facebook page, as much as I despise this administration's attack on the FBI and the CIA, I cannot help but remember FBI actions like COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program. The politicized disparaging going on now is for trumped up reasons, literally, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't look at federal law enforcement agencies with some skepticism. And Mike emailed, point to an investigation that wasn't partisan. Benghazi? Clinton's email server, the same FBI that people are trying to hold in high esteem now, was being lambasted for its handling of the email investigation a little over a year ago. Hillary still blames James Comey for her loss. By the way, an accusation of partisan behavior against a few individuals is not an indictment of an entire investigation. Professor Olien, what do you think? How do we make sense of the discontent over the FBI, some of which feels very partisan, but other instances of which, like the COINTELPRO campaign against Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, is a very legitimate reason to distrust the FBI?
Look, the FBI is a tool. It's an instrument of federal power. It's an instrument of investigatory power, and it's an instrument of prosecutorial power too, when combined with the Justice Department. And that tool can be used in either noble or corrupt ways. And the recent history of the FBI over the last 50 years shows that it's often been used in a corrupt or suspicious way as a method to discredit or keep down political opponents. So I mean, if the claim here is that the FBI hasn't been squeaky clean during the civil rights era when it was investigating Martin Luther King, and perhaps in the 70s and 80s as well, I think that's right, although I'm not sure whether or not I would criticize the FBI itself for that. I would say more properly that civilian leaders have often used the FBI for corrupt reasons, and the FBI is just a neutral tool. And when it's placed in political hands, there can be problems associated with it. And I think that's one of the reasons why you want that distance between the White House, political leaders, and the FBI director. If the FBI director, who has no political interests, is directing the FBI and is allowed to do what he or she wants, then there's less likelihood that the tool, the instrument of the FBI, will be used in corrupt ways.
Well, but I think that's kind of, Professor Olien, I think that's part of the concern. I mean, the FBI, historically, for much of its history, was not a neutral tool. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover was in no way neutral, which is partly where all of this concern comes from. That if you believe the president, if you believe Congressman Nunes, if you believe a number of other members of, say, the Freedom Caucus and so forth, who see a partisan motivation for this, history bears out that personal prejudices and personal biases do affect law enforcement.
If I can jump in here, I think that sort of part of what's important to draw the distinction here, though, is that the process that Devin Nunes's memo is criticizing, the FISA memo and the FISA court, as you have previously discussed on the show today, is in fact a direct result of reforms after those scandals of the 1960s and 1970s, that the FISA system, which installed a level of unprecedented oversight and judicial checks and balances on the rights of and the ability of the FBI to conduct surveillance on U.S. persons, is a direct outgrowth of the nation being troubled by what it saw in the 1960s and 1970s.
Right.
And the Church Committee and the post-Watergate surveillance reforms led to the process that we now have that is sort of, by all accounts, working just fine. Mm-hmm. That actually this memo, I don't think in any way actually proves in any respect that the FBI abused the FISA system. And in fact, it underscores at multiple points the number of different people who participated in this conversation, who looked at this evidence, who agreed that the FISA process was rightly deployed against former Trump advisor Carter Page. You have Democrats and Republicans in the Justice Department. You have federal judges. You have career FBI, Department of Justice, and court judiciary staff all involved in the process.
Right.
And that this is very much a system in direct response to the fear of abuse of power.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Let's add one more voice to the conversation. Joining us now on the line from Chicago is Democratic Congressman Mike Quigley. He serves on the House Intelligence Committee. Congressman Quigley, welcome to 1A.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Give us a sense of some of the conversations that you and your colleagues are having now. It's been the weekend. The memo has had its first spin through the news cycle. What happens now? What's the strategy going forward?
Well, about 4 o'clock Chicago time, my committee will meet again in a business committee meeting, and we will vote on whether to release the minority memo. And then that memo will go to the White House, and we'll see just how consistent the president wants to be with this process, because he has the same 5 days to review and decide whether or not that memo should be released. Overall, it's... last week was probably as contentious and ugly as I've seen the partisan politics over intel issues. I'd like to think we reboot, start over, and get back to what's really important here. Mike Morrell called what the Russians did during the election the political equivalent of 9/11. So whatever else is said about this memo, let's remember its purpose was to be a distraction, part of a pattern of behavior by the chairman and the White House to deflect, distract, delay, and frankly obstruct what we're trying to accomplish there.
And you're referring to Mike Morrell, the former head of the CIA?
Yes.
Let me play you a clip of Republican Congressman Trey Gowdy of South Carolina. He commented on the memo's release on CBS News' Face the Nation. Here is part of what Mr. Gowdy had to say.
There is a Russia investigation without a dossier. So to the extent the memo deals with the dossier and the FISA process, the dossier has nothing to do with the meeting at Trump Tower. The dossier has nothing to do with an email sent by Cambridge Analytica. The dossier really has nothing to do with George Papadopoulos' meeting in Great Britain. It also doesn't have anything to do with obstruction of justice.
That was Republican Congressman Trey Gowdy speaking on Face the Nation. Congressman Quigley, what do you think of what Mr. Gowdy had to say?
I was pleased he had something to say like that. And the fact that one of my other Republican colleagues, Charlie Dent, was on CNN saying almost the exact same thing, that the memo should not, he said the memo should not have been released. It was partisan. It damaged the relationship between the intelligence community, helped fracture the trust with Congress, and revealed sources and methods. So I'm pleased to see some Republicans stepping out and saying the right thing. If you want to track this, those two Republicans and Senator Flake, who also said some bold and strong things about this president, they're all leaving Congress. So I hope that's not a pattern that people start to speak the truth only when they discover that they're leaving this body.
We're up against the clock, and we do have more we want to discuss with you. But just briefly, would you handicap for me how likely you think it is that we will get to see this Democratic memo?
I think there's no doubt that the committee will vote to release it. But we have an extraordinarily impulsive president who is in high protection mode. I think all of this reflected Mr. Nunez, the White House, even the Speaker of the House, the fact that they were far more concerned with protecting the president legally and politically than they were protecting our country. It seems like a strong thing to say, but it's unavoidable. And how do I handicap what the president's going to do?
Right.
I don't think anyone can do that when they wake up in the morning, because he's extraordinarily impulsive and obviously in defense mode.
Well, hold that, how far the hold that thought right there, Congressman. We'll continue with you in just a minute. Hold that thought, and I'll get back to you in a sec. Stay close. Before we get back to our conversation, we would love your help with tomorrow's program on paid family leave.
Family and medical leave is a matter of pure common sense and a matter of common decency. It will provide Americans what they need most, peace of mind.
On this date in 1993, President Clinton signed the Family Medical Leave Act into law. But now, 25 years later, many workers still struggle to take paid time off for newborns, spouses, or relatives. There is talk of improving the laws on paid leave. What would you like Congress to consider from your own personal experience if they update this law? How has family leave worked for you or not worked? Leave us a voicemail. 855-236-1A1A. How has the Family Medical Leave Act affected your life? Did it work for you? Did it fail you? Tell us your story. 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212, and we will share some of your stories tomorrow on 1A. Back now to our conversation with Cornell University law professor Jens David Olin, Garrett Graff, the author of The Threat Matrix, The FBI at War in the Age of Global Terror, and Democratic Congressman Mike Quigley of Illinois. Congressman, I wonder if you could respond to Tricia, who's listening from Cincinnati. Tricia writes, "Is a real investigation even possible? I have teenagers, so just like politicians, if I suspect one of them of doing something wrong, I don't take a year to investigate. Any evidence there might have been will be long gone. Washington investigations sound to me like letting my son pick several peers to investigate his bad behavior, determine guilt, and then consequences." Congressman?
Well, it took over a year to investigate Watergate, and the system worked. I don't like the fact that it takes so long, but it does. It's also extraordinarily difficult to complete this investigation in the minority, right? I mean, we're not in control of the House. They spent 3 years investigating Benghazi, spent tens of millions, found nothing. I suppose the good news there is, in a comparatively short period of time, there's already been 4 indictments here under Mueller's investigation. And if you had told me months ago that we would have learned that the president's son was offered dirt on Hillary Clinton from his father's Russian business partners on behalf of a senior Russian government official, and he said, "I love it," and that we'd known about Jared Kushner's attempts to get back channels to Russia, George Papadopoulos, Roger Stone, Alexander Nix, Carter Page. It's not easy, and my colleagues on the other side have thrown extraordinary roadblocks in our way. Mr. Nunez, in addition to last week's efforts and his refusal to acknowledge that they're working with the White House on this memo, he's refused to sign subpoenas, investigate Peter Smith, the Illinois-based Republican operative. So it hasn't been easy, and it's going to take a lot longer. But if Watergate was algebra, this is calculus. We're dealing with a foreign adversary. I mean, think about that. You're not exactly going to subpoena a Russian oligarch, but it's the most important investigation of our lifetime. Please don't let the fact that it's going to take a long time deter you from understanding that we need to get it done.
Professor Olin, I love that analogy. If Watergate was algebra, this is calculus. Maybe that leans toward the answer to Tricia's question being more negative as to whether a real investigation is even possible, particularly because partisanship is so involved. But what do you think?
I think that the investigation is proceeding with one hand tied behind its back because the evidence the most relevant evidence is in Russia, and it's inside the Kremlin, and we're never going to have access to that. So in a sense, the investigation is, you know, sort of like a donut. It's, you know, building a pastry with a big hole in the center. And, you know, it's a lot of inference because we just don't know exactly what the Kremlin was doing. We don't know who was coordinating with them. We're working with limited pieces of information. And I would also say that, you know, we had an independent counsel law, and for many years we had independent investigations. That's what happened to Bill Clinton when Ken Starr engaged in his investigation, and there was real sort of teeth to the independent counsel law. And now we have a special counsel who's operating in an environment where the investigation is under constant siege. I mean, every single week people are asking, will the Mueller investigation continue? Will it succeed? Will it be shut down? Will Rod Rosenstein be fired? And will someone else at the Justice Department be placed in that spot who will tighten up the reins on Mueller? And I think that's also one of the problems here, which is that the investigation is operating in an environment where its very existence is being questioned on a daily basis.
Rosie Beda tweeted, "Stop it. If there needs to be a conversation about past corruption in the FBI, this isn't the time. You are supporting Trump's narrative and participating in the distraction. Russia is here. Trump is a criminal. Our nation is at risk." Garrett Graff, what about that top part of Rosie Beda's comment? Is this the wrong time to be talking about past corruption in the FBI?
I think it depends on what era of corruption one's talking about. I do think that this is sort of the people who are talking about and sort of pointing at the abuses of the civil rights era. You know, that's sort of a Soviet-style whataboutism that is in fact not helpful and sort of undermines the process as it's unfolding right now. I do think, though, that there are legitimate questions around the FBI's behavior over the last 2 years. I think it is hard to separate in this investigation some of the behavior and actions of then FBI Director Comey in response to the Hillary Clinton email investigation, which all evidence shows the FBI actually bent over backwards to make public and to discuss publicly time and again, even with interim inconclusive results, while at the same time keeping quiet about what we now understand was an increasingly sprawling and multifaceted investigation into Russia's influence in the 2016 election, both in terms of information operations conducted online, as well as the hacking of the DNC and John Podesta, and also these contacts that the Trump campaign organization appears to have had with officials and nationals from Russia. That in fact, if you remember, Harry Reid sent a very strongly worded letter in the fall before the election to Jim Comey saying, you know, "Director, you have important knowledge that you are not making public about a foreign country's meddling in our election." And that absolutely is fair to be part of this conversation, I think, right now.
Congressman Quigley, I wonder how you see the prospect of working across the aisle with your Republican colleagues on a step on moving forward with this investigation. Here's how Speaker Paul Ryan, speaking to the press last week, he says he supported the release of the memo. Here's part of what he had to say.
First, there are legitimate questions about whether an American's civil liberties were violated by the FISA process. We are the legislative branch of government. It is our job to conduct oversight on behalf of the American people of the executive branch in case any powers were abused and civil liberties were abused by the executive branch. So there's a very legitimate issue here as to whether or not an American's civil liberties were violated in the FISA process. That's point number one. Point number two. This is a completely separate matter from Bob Mueller's investigation, and his investigation should be allowed to take its course. Point number three, there may have been malfeasance by people at the FBI. Let me finish my points. There may have been malfeasance at the FBI by certain individuals. So it is our job in conducting transparent oversight of the executive branch to get to the bottom of that.
That was House Speaker Paul Ryan speaking last week. Congressman Quigley, what the House Speaker said kind of dovetails with a question from Jamie, who's listening in St. Louis. And Jamie wrote, no matter how irresponsible Nunes and company are behaving, and no matter my low opinion of the current administration, isn't it healthful to have a review of our system of secrecy? Isn't it good now and then to let bright sunlight flood into our two automatically secret government operations? Congressman?
I suppose if it wasn't so wildly hypocritical, we're talking about timing. If the Speaker and the Chairman, Chairman Nunes, and the House Republicans were so concerned about the FISA process, why wasn't this memo released as part of the discussion during the larger debate on 702 reauthorization held just a few weeks ago? That was the forum to talk about this issue.
I'm sorry, Congressman, just to be clear, Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act lets the government obtain communications of foreigners outside the U.S., including foreign terrorist threats.
So that was the forum to discuss that issue. What you're seeing now is opportunistic, rogue, partisan attempts to distract. You know, if the Speaker of the House is so concerned about transparency, why wasn't transparency thought about a week ago? When I asked Chairman Nunes, did you or any of your staff work with the White House preparing this memo, he refused to answer the question. Where was the Speaker of the House last week when we asked that the Justice Department and FBI's request to talk in executive session to the entire body about the concerns with accuracy and what this will mean to national security to release this memo, when they said no? And the request, where was the Speaker when we asked, can we release our memo at the same time, even if it takes you a few days to review? So it's transparency when they're trying to do the president's bidding. And it's not exactly profiles encouraged by the Speaker of the House.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Professor Olean, I wonder if you could quickly answer this question from Marianne. We're low on time, but she asks a good one. Marianne wants to know, shouldn't questions of an application to the FISA court be settled by the FISA court? Why is one side of a charge being seen as enough? Professor?
Well, because I don't think the House Intelligence Committee isn't claiming that the warrant was was issued inappropriately. They're really making a process point and not a substance point. The other problem is that the House Intelligence Committee doesn't have standing to go to the FISA court and complain about this issue. Really, the government, the executive branch, the FBI, and the Justice Department, they're the ones saying that the FISA warrant application was appropriate, and then the subject of the warrant page could certainly object to it at a later point in time, but I don't think he would have much basis to complain about what's in the Nunes memo. And so I think the problem is here that there's a mismatch between the people who really want to issue the complaints, which is Nunes and the other Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee, and the fact that they really have no standing to appear before the FISA court.
And Professor, I think it's also worth briefly noting that to get a reauthorization for these warrants, you have to show that the last warrant you got yielded something new. You have to go back every 90 days, as this memo stated. So they couldn't keep coming back with the Steele dossier, for example, saying, we still want more time with this. They have to show that the warrant they already got worked. Isn't that right?
That's right. That's right.
John in Baltimore writes, so which is it? Is the release of the memo a nothing burger or the end of democracy? Garrett Graff, I wonder what your take on that is, particularly from the law enforcement perspective of the FBI trying to continue being part of this investigation and do their jobs effectively. How impactful is this to actually getting to the bottom of all this?
I don't necessarily know that it's an either-or choice. I think what you saw sort of wrapped up in the Nunes memo controversy was sort of simultaneously both nothing and everything, which is that the memo itself demonstrates very little now that we have seen it and have the opportunity to review it. But at the same time, the process that led to it and the controversy surrounding it shows the collapse of the nonpartisan, bipartisan oversight of the intelligence community that has really been the model for congressional leadership on both sides of the aisle for more than 40 years. And I think that that's something that really should trouble us, which is we are seeing the intelligence community sort of being weaponized in bad faith by the Republican members of the Intelligence Committee in order to try to muddy the waters and protect their own. And that's something that is not something that we have historically seen since the creation of the intelligence committees post-Watergate.
Congressman, we are low on time, but I wonder if I might wrap up, or at least start to wrap up with you, in terms of whether or not the president agrees to release this memo and what the recourse for that might be. Elliot tweeted, if some in the committee were to leak the Democratic memo, what would the consequences be? And Rebecca in Gloucester, Virginia writes, if the president does not allow release of Democratic memo, how can the public demand its release? Congressman, we're low on time, but what are the options if President Trump says, no, the public can't see this?
There's really no options other than someone, as you say, leaking it, which would be a grievous crime. We don't want to exacerbate, I think, wrongdoing on the Republican side by doing something worse. Other than public outrage and pressure from Republicans in the House and Senate, I don't know of a recourse, and it is what concerns me. We're talking about a constitutional crisis in the future. I think we're seeing constitutional clashes now that could raise to that point. It's of great concern. The bottom line, though, let's get that memo out, because it does rebut, point by point, the majority's memo. It actually has footnotes. It's four times as long. It includes evidence no one has seen publicly yet, which will actually bolster the credibility of the investigation.
And I'm sorry, Congressman, to cut you short, but our time is limited. Barney in Arlington, Virginia wants to know if it's been vetted by the FBI and the Justice Department. Has it?
Yes, it has. We asked the intelligence community to vet ours. The Republicans refused to do that with their memo.
That's Democratic Congressman Mike Quigley of Illinois. Congressman, we really appreciate your time. Sir, thanks for talking to us.
Sure. Thank you.
Cornell University Law Professor and Vice Dean Jens David Olien. Professor Olien, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And Garrett Graff, the author of The Threat Matrix, The FBI at War in the Age of Global Terror. Garrett, thank you.
My pleasure.
Remember to share your stories about how the Family Medical Leave Act helped you or failed you. 855-236-1A1A. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. This is 1A.